What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
The Economist.
It almost has the makings of a fairy tale. A charismatic preacher leads his followers into the forest. And there, they are forever changed. But this story from Kenya is no fairy tale.
An update now on a disturbing story out of Kenya that we've been following very closely. More than 300 bodies have been found in shallow graves in a forest, and authorities say scores of mass graves are yet to be uncovered. Most of the victims were followers of a controversial pastor who is now in police custody.
A year ago, these gruesome events gripped both Kenya and the rest of the world. Hundreds of bodies, men, women, children, were found in the forest, starved to death. At the core of the story is a question of faith. Many of the people who followed that pastor into the forest did so willingly. They did so because they believed that he knew how to get them into heaven. Instead, he created a hell on earth. I'm Ore Ogunbiyi, and this is The Weekend Intelligence. It's been an entire year since the world became aware of the bizarre deaths in the forest. That controversial pastor, Paul McKenzie, is now on trial. Kenyan journalist Kerry Baraka, supported by the Pulitzer Center, has spent the past year reporting the story for our 1843 magazine. He tells The Weekend Intelligence how and why it happened. Hi, Kerry.
Hi, Ore. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for coming on The Weekend Intelligence.
Thank you for having me.
So, Kerry, where are you at the moment? Is that cicadas I can hear in the background?
Yes, exactly, yeah. I live in Nairobi, but around 20 kilometers from the city center, which means where I live, there's a lot of greenery, a lot of animals. So even right now, the fact that I can hear the cicadas means that, like, it's probably going to be dry for the next few hours because they usually come out when it's dry and hide when it's raining.
Now, Kerry, this story broke just over a year ago. Tell me about your reporting process since then.
Yeah, I remember when the story first broke, I was paying sort of distance attention to it, but then I became very actively involved around July. The thing that still astounds me is how many people I talked to for the story. Around Shakahola, Malindi itself, I talked to easily 40 people or 50 people, you know. Just going around the town, talking to NGO case workers, talking to former members of the church, talking to McKenzie's family members, talking to police officers, people who used to work with the children who were rescued from the church, relatives of those who had been in the church. But even beyond that, I think I attended, I was attending like all these evangelical church services in Nairobi and also in Mombasa, near where McKenzie's church was, because I was trying to understand the sort of philosophical spring these churches come from. So between like all those such services and all the people I was talking to, it took me months just to understand the background of what was happening.
And what's the hardest thing in reporting a story like this?
I think the difficult thing with this story is mostly the psychological element. It's a lot of people dying, right? When I first signed the commission with the Economist, I used to joke with my editor that the Economist needs to pay for therapy for me because it's a lot of horrific things are happening in this story. But I think fundamentally, there's very little a person can do to prepare themselves psychologically.
So, Kerry, this story all started in Shakahola. Take me there. Tell me a little bit about Shakahola.
It's a really small town that is located 50 kilometers from Malindi, which is one of the big tourist centers in Kenya. And it's like this place with like sandy beaches, it's next to the Indian Ocean, like sun all year round. It's so popular that like it's called Little Italy because there are a lot of like Italian people who like live there and like go to have holidays there. It's a very remote place and there's the town of Shakahola, but then right next to the town there's a forest and no one lives in this forest, or at least nobody lived there until a pastor called Paul Mackenzie showed up with his followers.
How did people first find out about what Paul Mackenzie was doing in the forest?
So when the residents of Shakahola town realized that there were people living in the forest, it was very weird for them because the forest, like every forest in Kenya, not only does it not have the amenities of modern living, whether it's electricity or like running water or good telecommunication lines, it also has a lot of really dangerous animals. And yeah, we're talking about lions and leopards and cheetahs and buffaloes and hyenas and hippos and snakes. All the things you find on Kenyan safaris like in this forest. And so because of this, people don't live in this forest, right? While the people in Shakahola town thought it was strange that people were living in the forest, to them things became even stranger towards the end of January 2023 and start of February. Because initially you'd have groups of women coming to the town accompanied with their children to buy whatever things they needed from the local shops. But then around end of January, the children seem to disappear and it's just the women coming and they wonder, where have your children gone? But then as the week seep into February, first of all, the amount of women coming to the town itself starts to reduce. But also the women who come to the town suddenly appear frailer, they appear weaker, and the residents of the town don't know what is happening.
That's really eerie. So people had started arriving into the town quite mysteriously a year or two before, and now just as mysteriously, they started disappearing. How did the local people discover what was going on?
The people in the town try and go to the forest to engineer a rescue of people who are starving. And a group of them, led by one of the village elders in the town, walks into the forest. And when they go into the forest, they see a group of women who are lying down on the forest floor. And this is really very weird for them, because if you lie down on a forest floor in Kenya, basically that is you saying that you want to be attacked by hyenas, because hyenas will attack anything they think is dead. And so these women are lying down on the floor of the forest. And the women seem to be weak, and the group of people from the town walk closer to them because they want to rescue them. But then before they can get there, a group of men armed with machetes emerges from the forest. And the group of men tells them to mind their own business, to get out of the forest, because whatever is happening there has nothing to do with them. And so the townspeople are forced to retreat and they go back to the town. At some point in February, a group of children were found wandering in the forest by some of the herders who had gone to the forest. This group of children told the herders that they were running away from the camp where Mackenzie and his followers had been living. And the herders staked the boys back to the town. And the boys told the residents of the town a really shocking story.
A controversial Malindi televangelist was on Thursday charged with alleged starving children to death in Shakahola area. In what they termed as cultic practices, the Directorate of Criminal Investigation...
And it is at this point that the first reports emerge in Kenyan media that there's this pastor in Malindi about whom it is rumored that some of his followers
might have starved to death in a forest.
Says the Directorate of Criminal Investigations officers say the televangelist Paul McKenzie of Good News International Ministries has been preaching to his followers to drink water only to avert a looming disaster.
Okay, so let's park the story there for a moment. Tell me about McKenzie. Who is this guy? Where does he come from? What's his story?
Paul McKenzie is this really fiery evangelical preacher. To understand who McKenzie is and how he became who he is, you have to understand where he comes from. McKenzie was born in a small town called Lunga Lunga, which is somewhere very close to Kenya's border with Tanzania. And he was born in a big family. There were 10 kids. The household was a very religious household. They would pray every day. And then the entire family belonged to this church called the African Brotherhood Church, which was an evangelical church that was started in Kenya in the 1940s. It was a sort of way to support African Christians in this country where colonization is still happening. And even when he was really young, McKenzie was very involved in the church. I spoke to McKenzie's brother, Robert, and he told me that, you know, his brother used to be not only a Sunday school teacher when he was very young, but also he became a choir master when he was barely out of his teens. Then in 1995, he moved to Malindi to live with an older sister of his who lived in the town. His sister bought him a cab to run a taxi service. So he's living in Malindi, he's figuring things out. But then around the turn of the millennium, a couple of pivotal things happen in his life. First of all, he joins a Baptist church. And then very shortly after, he gets married. And at the same time, in this Baptist church, he quickly establishes himself as one of the preachers in the church because he has a very captivating tone.
Hallelujah. Wacha tu unasema unaogopa kufa. Kufa ndio njia kwa mwenye haki.
So this is from a relatively early sermon when the church was still in Malindi. And in essence, he's saying that the true believer should not be terrified of death. If death is what brings you salvation, then you should be willing to just die.
Wow.
And he's made a leader in the church and he becomes friends with some of the most influential people in the church. He's still doing the taxi business, but like more and more, he's spending more time as a preacher in the church. He has very, very powerful sermons, which mostly revolve around the idea of like the end of times. And this new sermons bring in new worshippers to the church. But he makes a very controversial sermon. And in his sermon, he says that God is coming back to earth soon, but there's one thing that has to happen before he can come back. The leader of the church has to die. That is the condition that God has before he can come back to earth. And he tells the church that this is what he was told by God. And of course, the leader of the church is very angry at this and he's kicked out of the church. And this is the point when he starts his own church.
But then his views get a bit more extreme, right?
Yeah. McKenzie starts this new church and it's called House of the Lord. And he starts it with a couple who are also members of the Baptist church. The two people from Malindi called David Kahindi and Ruth Kadzo. She told me that when they started the church initially, she thought that they were all just trying to get people to convert to Christianity. But then at some point, McKenzie started making sermons and edicts or even more controversial than his previous ones. And one of the big ones was about healthcare. And he said that healthcare was, in essence, a sin against God. That, you know, you shouldn't use earthly medicine, you shouldn't go to earthly hospitals, you should trust in God.
So he's forced out of one church because he was saying that the church leader has to die in order for God to return to earth again. And he's now set up his own church with a couple, Ruth and David, and he's going around telling his congregants and his fellow church leaders not to seek medical help, and let nature take its course instead.
At the same time, McKenzie's own wife is also not in agreement with the things he's saying about healthcare. And matters come to a head and he and his wife argue a lot about this. And then she's expectant and she doesn't go to hospital
until the very last moment. And then she dies during childbirth.
Wow.
So after his wife dies, he gets married again to someone from his church, a woman called Joyce Mukamba. And she actually becomes his biggest supporter. So much so that when he starts becoming more open about the things he's saying, she's there beside him. And the main thing is that before this, he used to tell his members of the church that education was a sin. But now he adds another thing, which is to tell them that they should actively remove their children from school. And so a bunch of members of the church remove the children from school. But one person who is upset that her grandchildren are being withdrawn from school ends up reporting him to the police. And this is the first time he or his church appears in the national news.
Paul McKenzie, the controversial preacher, was arrested for misleading residents where some parents have lost control over their children who drop out of school to live with the preacher in his church. 35 children under the age of 10 years. So, Kerry, what's going on here?
So he had opened his own school where most of the people who had removed their children from school, some of them were taking them to McKenzie's school. So one of the people I spoke to in Malindi is a man called Titus Katana, who was one of the deputy pastors of the church. And he used to help McKenzie when he'd go to crusades to try and convert people to the church. And so when McKenzie tells the members of the church to remove their children from school, Katana is one of the people who removes his children from school. But then at some point, he changes his mind and returns his children to school. And then he himself resigns from the church. Shortly after Katana leaves the church, McKenzie tells his followers that they have to go into the wilderness to pray. And this is of something he gets from the Bible, from the book of Revelations, about a woman who goes to pray in the wilderness for 1260 days before she goes to heaven. And so he tells them that they have to go to the wilderness to pray. And around November, December 2019, a small group of believers moves into the forest with McKenzie, and they're very happy to be there.
How many people are we talking about here, Kerry?
We don't have exact numbers, but estimates put it between a few dozen to an upper limit of maybe 100 people. But then one of the things Titus Katana told me is that in March 2020, something happened which changed everything completely.
Hii sinema ya corona ndio ilileta problem kidogo kwa sababu mafundisho ni kwamba watu wazi kwenda hospitali ni dhambi.
Fellow Kenyans, I want to inform you that the Ministry of Health has confirmed the first coronavirus case in Kenya.
In essence, in March, when the first case of COVID-19 is announced in Kenya, it seems like vindication for everything McKenzie had been preaching about.
Because
one of the first things that happens is that the government declares every school closed as a measure to safeguard against spread of the virus. And immediately this happens, McKenzie goes to his followers and tells them, didn't I tell you that all the schools of the world are evil and that they were going to be closed? But then after that, there are vaccine mandates, of course.
This is when the Kenyan government said that Kenyans had to have the COVID vaccine to access government services.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. These are people who like genuinely believe that putting a vaccine into your body was a way of harming your body and was against like the commandments of God. And all these people who have been watching his sermons on the YouTube channel, they get his number from the YouTube channel and they call him and text him to ask him if there's a safe place they can be to hide from the COVID mandates. And he tells them to come to the forest. So people come into Shakahola from Malindi town and then from like Nairobi, from Uganda, from Tanzania, from like different countries in Africa. And then like they start living in the forest. By the end of 2020, because of COVID, there were a few thousand people living in the forest. And so the forest is partitioned into these zones where people are given like plots of land for really, really low prices. I think like you could get like 1 acre of land for $10 or $15 or something equally crazy. And you get like your plot of land and you're assigned, this is where you're going to live, and then you build your house. One of the people I spoke to who moved into the forest really early on, she told me that it felt really idyllic to her. They're living in nature and they're getting like fresh air and it's not loud at all, and they can grow like crops for themselves near their houses. And a lot of the people who were living there had been living in poverty. And so this is a change from like having to struggle to get food to all of a sudden they're growing like small amounts of food around them. So she told me that it honestly was really idyllic for them.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
So somehow this forest, which is largely uninhabitable, begins to feel idyllic compared to everything that's going on outside in the rest of the world with COVID. But then things began to go a bit wrong, right?
At the end of 2022, they are told that they should start preparing to get to heaven, and the preparation for going to heaven is going to involve them fasting. They are told that at some point they're going to start eating less and less food. So it's phased, right? So maybe like the food they eat should reduce by like half at some point, and then another half, and then ultimately, they would now stop eating food altogether.
And that's when it turned fatal.
Yeah, maybe end of January, start of February, the fasting started en masse. And that's at the point when the people who didn't want to fast began to like make attempts to run away from the forest.
And this is when the police are called and come to the forest for the first time, right?
Yeah, so this is when the police come to the forest for the first time. One guy had reported that his grandchildren, he feared that they had starved to death in the forest because he had stories about what was happening there. And the police went with him to the forest and they actually rescued another of his grandchildren. And the child said that his siblings had been mired in some unmarked graves in the forest. And so because of that, the police went to Malindi town, to Mackenzie's house, and they arrested him in his house for the first time. And I spoke to a journalist in Malindi, Alex Kalama, and he told me that after they arrested him, they made the biggest mistake in the case.
He was released with a bond of 10,000 shillings.
He's taken to court, but then he's released on bail for very, very ludicrously small amount.
And then after that, then the worst thing comes from that day he was released by a bond.
He goes back to the forest from Malindi.
And in that time, people start dying.
People were dying in the forest already. But I spoke to one of the police officers in Malindi who was involved in investigating the case. And he told me that when pathologists ended up going to the forest, they found that a lot of the bodies that they recovered seemed to have died in the three-week period between Mackenzie being released on bond and police officers finally showing up in the forest. Also, a lot of these people didn't seem to have died by starvation, but they had marks on their bodies that seemed to suggest they had been strangled.
Strangled?
Yes, that they had been strangled, that some had like marks on their wrists and legs that seemed to show that they had been tied up. Some seem to have suffocated, to suggest that like when they were buried, they weren't yet dead.
How did strangling come about? What happened in these 3 weeks?
So the stories from people who survived, people ran away from the forest, is that at certain points, a huge chunk of people changed their mind about fasting, and these people wanted to leave the forest. But then they weren't allowed to leave the forest. And there was apparently a team in the forest whose job it was to make sure that these people continued fasting. And so some of them were tied up and locked in houses. Some were tied up to trees. But then there were all these bodies which were exhumed from the forest. And these bodies had marks of strangulation. and marks of suffocation. And what pathologists determined is that these people seem to have died from being strangled rather than because they had starved.
Do we know how many people might have died?
So we still don't know for certain how many people died in the forest. But I spoke to Jacinta Mbeyu, who is a human rights worker based in Malindi. She works for an organization called Haki Africa, which were very involved in trying to rescue people in the forest. And she went to the forest on the day the pathologist showed up. She was doing like a human rights event in the town. And we talked while we were driving between the two events.
Actually have the numbers we know of the bodies that have been exhumed, yes, but we also know from the reports that we have as the center there are very many people that are in that forest still.
How many people roughly?
A number of them, quite a big number, because if there are over 300 families and the bodies that were actually exhumed were over 400 bodies, and yet for each family we are talking about four people to I don't know 10 people per family, that simply means that there are quite a lot of people in that forest.
So there could be like even like 1,000?
Yeah.
That's awful. Hundreds and hundreds of bodies found in the forest and probably more still out there. What's happened to his followers now? Where did the rest of them go when they were rescued?
The ones who were rescued were taken to rescue centers in Malindi where they could be looked after by medical professionals. But the problem the government had was that people who were rescued did not want to be rescued because they felt that they were waiting to die so that they can go to heaven. And they felt that all these people coming to rescue them are the evil people of the world who are preventing them from going to heaven. And so because of this, there's like a tricky thing that happened when they were taken to rescue centers where almost all of them refused to eat.
That puts rescuers like Jacinta in quite a tough position, right? She's trying to save them, but they feel that they're being saved by not eating.
Yeah, that's part of the tragedy of this case, that no one actually knows what to do with these people because their belief in the message of fasting as a way to get to heaven is still strong.
What happens to Mackenzie now?
So Mackenzie is currently undergoing trial.
Paul Mackenzie was seen as a pastor by some, but he'll stand before Kenyan judges, accused of encouraging followers of his Good News International Church to starve themselves in order to reach heaven.
Him and 94 of the senior people in the church are undergoing trial. They've been charged for murder, they've been charged for manslaughter, and they've been charged for torture.
Is there any sense of remorse when Mackenzie appears at trial?
So usually what happens when Mackenzie is brought to court is that like he'll put like a fist in the air and he'll say something to his followers, some sort of like call and response thing, and they'll respond. And he seems to like take a lot of pride in having fun with journalists. Like in this one clip, he is telling them that if you want to take photos, take photos, like go ahead. And then at some point he tells them that you guys, you don't know who you're fighting with. And whatever you're fighting with will come back and beat you guys. And that is still the attitude he has whenever he talks in court or whenever he talks to journalists while he's entering court.
Wow, okay, so he's not remorseful at all.
He's actually doubling down. And in fact, Paul Mackenzie has been writing letters to his followers from prison.
New evidence filed before the Shanzu Law Courts on Thursday shows that Shakaola cult leader Paul Mackenzie is using letters to further instruct his followers in and outside prison to continue fasting until death. This comes after a letter containing his cultic teachings was discovered by investigating officers, raising concerns over the mechanism used by the main suspect to continue indoctrinating his followers.
You can see it even when people are brought to the court that while Mackenzie himself is very healthy, some of his followers are tying up to court being very frail, very emaciated. Some of them faint outside the courtroom because they're very weak. But also, one of them actually died.
Wow.
From starving himself when he was in prison. It's very sad how even a year after they were removed from the forest, most of them still steadfastly believe that by starving themselves to death, they will go to heaven.
Do you think Mackenzie believes that? Do you think he actually believes that the people who are starving themselves to death are going to go to heaven?
I don't know. I've been going back and forth about this over the past year or so, because like the other motivations people usually have, that like say he was doing this as a long con to get people's land and property, doesn't make sense because he doesn't seem to have benefited financially from the entire thing. And I think it's easier to like pass with his senior followers, because his very senior followers, including his number two, their children actually starved to death, you know? And the fact that someone could actually make their own child starve means that they most likely truly believed in it. But for Mackenzie himself, even when he said that children should be the first ones to starve, his own child never starved. His wife never starved when the other women were starving. She's still very much alive. So because of that, there's a bit of doubt about whether he genuinely believed that making people starve was the way to make them go to heaven.
And what about back in Malindi and Shakahola? How are people there making sense of what happened?
There's a man I spoke to who was involved in rescuing people. When the children escaped the forest, they lived in his house. The horror of what was happening and the fact that they didn't know until boys escaped is still with him. People like Jacinta, or people who like went to the forest, like they still have this sort of psychological trauma from what they saw.
It actually rings in my head day to day. I can actually see it. Probably I'd be traveling, doing some other errands. But again, the images come back. They reflect in my mind.
This is an incredibly tough story to even hear you talking about. How did it affect you reporting on it, speaking to these people and going to the forest?
One time I had a dream where Mackenzie was in the dream and was like a bit like scary. But whenever I've had like watched like the footage of Mackenzie's sermons in his church, I'm filled with this rush of rage towards him that like he was preaching all these things and people ended up dying.
How likely is it that something like this could happen again? What are the signs that you think people should maybe be keeping an eye out for when they're dealing with other pastors? I mean, you said you watch his sermons and you're filled with rage. What should people be looking out for?
I don't know. It's tricky because behind every religion is a suspension of belief. Every religion involves you as a person in it, like having a bit of faith in whatever the religious leader is telling you. So it's tricky to like tell people what their internal senses should pigeonhole as this is the line, you know? Because Mackenzie in his sermons, a lot of the things he says don't differ too drastically from what a lot of evangelical preachers say. I find that like in African churches, the cabal is always like linked to like some anti-colonial movement. So it's like the Americans or the British or the Pope want to control Africans in this and this way. So you must like resist them, because by resisting them, you're going to be prepared for like the second coming of Jesus Christ, which is soon. And so for Mackenzie, he said all of these things. And the only difference between him and like a lot of these preachers is that he added the extra step of you have to like prepare for the second return of Jesus Christ by fasting. And if you've been in this religion for like your entire life and you've believed everything that the preacher said, it's really hard at that moment to realize that, like, okay, this last 5%, after believing 95%, this last 5% is what I am going to not believe in.
One of the saddest takeaways for me from this story is how much of it wasn't actually that shocking. I think if, like you and I, you are African and you've heard about similar stories of evangelical pastors taking things way too far, really perverting what is the word of God and justifying really horrific acts in God's name, you wouldn't be surprised to hear lots of this, which I think is quite sad because this is one of the biggest mass killings in Kenya's history. But yeah, I think it's quite unfortunate that actually stories like these where people who are in power abuse that power and make people do really horrible things have become so commonplace that this isn't actually that shocking to me. Kerry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Weekend Intelligence. The reporter was Kerry Baraka and the producer was Barclay Bram. Sound design was by Nicholas Rufast and the executive producer of The Weekend Intelligence is Gemma Newby. We'll see you next time.
Next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.